Coming up next on Tech News Today, Twitter has a hard time translating awareness into new users, apparently. Also, Cortana is going to help you keep your promises. We take a closer look at Snap's IPO filing from last week. Facebook's safety check feature adds tools to those who want to help out when disaster strikes. And the challenges for police of analyzing petabytes of recorded body camera data. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1702, recorded Thursday, February 9th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase.
And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT.
And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT.
Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we tell you what you need to know about technology today. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. I've got Staying Alive stuck in my head right now.
We were doing some pre-show dancing.
As we normally do. It's how we get pumped up for the technology news.
Yeah, so now we deliver it without dancing.
Right, and without disco.
Early this morning, Twitter announced fourth quarter and fiscal year 2016 results. And the fact that every newscast you hear seems to start with the phrase, President Trump tweeted ... has seemed to have very little effect on the company's bottom line. User growth has slowed, revenue has slowed, and as a result, shares of the stock plummeted this afternoon. Now, this is normally the biggest quarter for advertising, and Twitter's ad revenue even still sunk. And as for people signing up, Recode points out this shocking comparison. During last year's heated election season, Twitter only grew by 2 million users. Sounds like a lot, except for when you read that Facebook grew by 72 million users.
We took you two and we add 70 million to it. No big deal.
Yeah. So COO Anthony Noto said the president has brought knowledge of Twitter and people are understanding how it might be able to be used. But that doesn't mean they're signing up for the service.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, there's this awareness of Twitter. If people hadn't heard about Twitter or didn't understand it before, well, it's probably likely they still don't understand it because there are many elements of Twitter that are kind of confusing. But they have heard of it enough to know that it is a place where certain people are talking a lot and sharing a lot of important information that's permeating into the media. I don't know how you turn those people, the people that aren't already on it, but they're getting a lot of the benefit from it already, thanks to, you know, journalism and media and all that kind of stuff's kind of spreading the word for the service. I don't know how you get them in the door, especially when you consider the fact that you don't have to be a user, a registered user of Twitter to get information from it in the same way that you do with Facebook. Like there's a little bit of public access in Facebook, but if you really want to get the benefit of the service, you have to have an account and log in and create that network. With Twitter, it's almost more like an RSS feed. And if you have an account, you have a little bit more customization, but you can still follow people 100% in more of a manual way if you don't have an account. And I think that's probably what a lot of people do. They do it on demand almost.
Yeah. I mean, Twitter still hasn't figured out the answer to the question that the average person asks, which is why would I need Twitter? Who would I follow? Why would I ever tweet? It seems really scary.
One, I think. Yeah.
It seems either I'm shouting into the void and no one is hearing me, or I slip up a little bit and then it's forwarded, you know, and it becomes viral and then my career or life is ruined. Like, facing those two things, a lot of people are like, why would I sign up for this? If I want to see what Donald Trump's tweets, I'll go to any newspaper or I'll just go to twitter.com Donald Trump, you know, or POTUS. And so that's all they need. And you're right. Like Facebook, you can't see very much and they do a really good job. I mean, I think how many of us, you know, just join Facebook, first of all, because it's like, oh, I wanted to see that. Right. And I can't see it.
And I'm like one
of
the last people that aren't on it. Yeah. And so I might as well get on so that I have access to seeing those things.
Right.
And
or like,
you never leave.
Like Instagram, you can see everybody's Instagram in the same way that Twitter works. You can, but Instagram is more fun to use. It's more, you know, you're more likely to want to upload a picture of, you know, just your photography or someone in your family or something. It's just, it's a kinder, gentler place, and people are more willing to be a part of it.
Yeah, and I think people in general, I mean, there are a million different ways that you can use any social network, but I think when you're talking about Instagram as an example, it's easier to understand because it's pictures, and you know, there's a lot of value. People can come up with a lot of ideas, why a lot of reasons why they might want to share a picture with someone. And there's also kind of that element of Instagram where you can use it on a personal level. And so, of course, you know who you're sharing things to and who's sharing to you and everything. They're pictures. I'm showing you a picture of my life and you care. So that's why I'm doing this. On Twitter, it's, yeah, sure, you can share pictures, but it's a lot more about words and it's less of a personal connection. It's more of like, I'm interested in following this person because I read their book and they're really cool. And I don't know. I think that there's a difference there for a lot of people that aren't on it. Because they're probably thinking to themselves, well, why do I want to do that? I already get the benefit of of knowing what they're up to based on their feed themselves. Why do I actually have to sign up? And then, like you said, throwing words out into the void and not getting anything in return. You do that a couple of times. I know so many people that have signed up for Twitter and they start off really strong, you know, like they're my friends from back home and they start off really strong. And then, man, you just get no more updates because I think from their perspective, it's like, who am I even talking to? Like, mm-hmm. And I'm not getting responses back on every single thing. So I don't know that anyone's even listening.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So yeah, they've lost 17 executives since January 2016. They're not doing so well.
But they did get more than 600 hours of live premium video content streamed throughout the quarter. So that's something that's a lot of content. That's obviously one of Twitter's kind of goals is to increase the number of the amount of content that they're creating there. 31 million unique visitors there, and depending on the platform that you're talking about, there again, you don't necessarily need to be signed into. To view some of this stuff, you know, if you're watching this video on different platforms, you can get access to it whether you have an account or not. So I don't know if that helps or hurts, but there you go. Microsoft is keeping you honest, or me honest if I was a Windows 10 user. At least that's one result of a new feature rolling out to Cortana that will remind you that you've made a promise to someone in an email when the time is right. Cortana will keep tabs on your emails and automatically send reminders for commitments made inside of those emails. Initial support right out of the gate for Outlook and Office 365 accounts, of course, but they're opening that up to more email services likely later. In Windows 10, you get a little notice that says, don't forget, you mentioned doing whatever it was, doing this thing, and then what you promised is shown to you and who to, and then you know once it appears, you get the ability to kind of snooze it or mark it as complete.
I like this. There's an app that I've been beta testing. It's called Zero. It's been around for a while, but they have a whole new AI feature to it where there's an assistant that will do sort of the same thing. It'll remind you when you have a task that not just that you've promised to someone, but that someone says, you know, can you have this by Friday? It'll automatically show you that email. There's a tab that says, you know, here are your tasks. This person asked you this question. This person asked you this question. And I find it's pretty useful. You know, already most email accounts, if there's a date in your email, it'll highlight it and you can just tap on it and add to your calendar, which is nice. Those are all really useful. I mean, I would use this. I hope that it eventually comes to the iOS version of Outlook because, make a lot of promises and I would like to keep them.
I think we all do with the amount of email that we're sending every single day. I mean, it's easy for a lot of this stuff to just kind of fall through the cracks. The guy who helped create it with his team, Eric Horovitz, Microsoft tech fellow, he created this partially for his own team internally because he realized that he was really bad at, you know, making claims, making promises in emails, and then just forgetting to follow up on it. He says keeping promises is, quote, key fabric of collaboration between people and teams, you know, kind of creating, building that trust, saying you're going to do something, following through on it. I'm all for if technology can do this automatically, and maybe sometimes it gets it wrong and you didn't need that reminder. But if you did need that reminder, that's a feature that I would totally keep around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do this now with I use Inbox, Google Inbox, Inbox for Google, Inbox for Gmail.
Yeah. Inbox. Yeah. Inbox. And you're really good at keeping Inbox Zero.
I am really good at it. And it's overwhelming. I'm not at Inbox Zero right now, and it's very stressful for me. But if I make a promise, then I just snooze it for the day that I've said, you know, oh, yeah, I'll deal with that next week. So I'll make it so it comes back up into my email, and it's basically the same thing. But I have to control it myself.
I'd end up snoozing everything. Always.
I know.
And it would keep coming up and be like, yes, news.
You are a very reliable co-host, I will say that, but you're not the best at email.
No, because I hate email. That's probably why. I apologize.
No, it's sad because it doesn't go with your real, your moral fiber, the rest of your moral. I know you want to make these promises, but you just forget. So.
That's why I need Cortana to do it for
me. You
do. Yeah.
In other news coming out of Redmond, Microsoft has convinced a federal judge to allow the company to sue the Department of Justice to protect the privacy of its customers. Now, when the government asks Microsoft to turn over email, the request also includes an indefinite gag order that says Microsoft is not allowed to tell its customers that they're being watched. And that's indefinite. They never have to tell them. Microsoft wants to take the DOJ to court to claim that the gag order itself is in violation of the First Amendment. The court also ruled that the government was doing wasn't in violation of the Fourth Amendment. So they said, yes, free speech. This is an issue of free speech. You can go ahead and sue them, but it's not a search and seizure violation of the Fourth Amendment. So yes on first, no on fourth. There we go.
Vote.
you don't get to vote there. No.
No, we have no ability to vote on this. Yeah.
Yet.
I mean, yes. Maybe someday. I mean, this is just indicative of where we're at right now with how we use technology and how much we rely on it, right? We as users and cloud, you know, cloud services, cloud storage of all of our accounts, Google, Microsoft, whatever your mobile platform is, as a result of using these platforms, we are keeping so much of our lives in the cloud and on servers that belong to these companies. So obviously, you get to know a lot about a person just by that massive data store that didn't exist in this way 30 years ago, let's say. I mean, it's just an entirely new world. So something like Sneak and Peek, I wasn't too aware of Sneak and Peek before kind of reading through it and everything, but that basically just allows law enforcement to kind of drop in without the user's knowledge, and many times no end date is given on that. So it's kind of like that spigot is open in perpetuity. User has absolutely no idea. Meanwhile, they're funneling insane amounts of information about their lives through this. So I don't know. Obviously, it's a big challenge for companies like Microsoft and Google who are managing all this information, because on one hand, you know, I'm sure they want to protect their users from things that might be seen as kind of overstepping the boundaries, and this might be one of those ways.
Right, but they also don't want to interfere with law enforcement.
Right, exactly.
And we don't want that too, and it's complicated. Right. So what they say is, like, there is room for gag orders. Mm-hmm. At times, if Microsoft will admit that if they revealed the fact that there was the government was looking, asking for the right to someone's information, then that might complicate the issue. And so, yes, like, sometimes a gag order is appropriate, but what they're saying is this is very broad. It's way too broad.
Super broad,
and
yeah.
That's why they're suing. And I really admire them. We talked earlier this week, Google got basically the opposite news, that you know that they couldn't sue, that this was because of the way they keep things in the cloud. It wasn't search and seizure. It wasn't violating anyone's amendments, but they're going to appeal that, of course. Twitter's also suing because they want to be able to reveal to us how many national security letters they receive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. There are all of these cases going on right now, and they seem to kind of fly in the face of each other. You know, it's landing all over the place. So I'm sure that means at one point a major rule, maybe, you know, I don't know how far that goes, the Supreme Court or whatever, to make that determination for good so that everybody has a precedent that can be followed.
Yeah.
That's kind of where we're headed.
I mean, but it's so very different what Microsoft, I mean, Microsoft not only keeps our email, but there's just all kinds of business documents, and mm-hmm. Google as well. Mm-hmm. But Twitter, it's more, you know, what we were just saying, like most Twitter accounts right. are public. But when you give access to the data, and you know, if Twitter is giving access to their fire hose, essentially, it's different. If they're letting, you know, the mm-hmm. government surveil like certain people who tweet from certain places or use certain hashtags, that's different. So it's each one of these companies should be treated differently because sure. the way that we and they reveal our information is very different.
Yeah, good point. Google is taking a big stab at cleaning outdated, potentially insecure apps from the Play Store by requiring developers to add or update their app's privacy policy. They gave the date of March 15th of this year. Basically, it's meant to force developers of so-called zombie apps that have essentially been abandoned for years that violate Google's user data policy to disclose to users why their apps need things like sensitive permissions and all that sort of stuff. Google says it'll limit visibility or remove those zombie apps altogether from the Play Store if nothing is done by the deadline. And yeah, I mean, this is nothing but good news as far as I'm concerned. You know, I don't know how much you went sifting through the Play Store when you had it, but you do a search for a certain type of app, and I mean, you're going to get apps that are as old as Android, since the days of old Android. And it's really hard to know. I mean, you can look at the last time it was updated and see that it was last updated in 2012, let's say. And so, you know, that's an indication to not install it. But I think there's a lot of people who just do a search, can't find the thing they're looking for, install something, and you don't know why that app says that it needed a particular access to a permission, or if it's even being updated at this point and potentially insecure as a result of all of that oversight, the lack of oversight.
Right. So they've gotten stricter in the Play Store over mm-hmm. the years, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they used to just let anybody in. I mean, some of these apps were the only thing they were in violation of was that they didn't have a privacy policy, like didn't right. have a privacy policy at all. I mean, an app would never get into the Apple App Store without a privacy policy. So right. they're cleaning it up. You're right. There's nothing good about this. I mean, we could call it the apocalypse, which I used on iOS, because they're also clearing out olds. They have this problem, too, but it's apps that haven't been updated in a few years, and they're still running 32-bit. And so they'll be not right. getting rid of them, not sweeping them out, but they won't be supported. Like a new beta of iOS, you know, people have seen screenshots that say, you know, this app will not be supported. As what they were saying before was, this app will slow down your iPad or your mm-hmm. iPhone, when it doesn't necessarily. But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely inevitable that we would get to this point with these app stores. Because up until, you know, I'd say the last couple of years, pretty much developers could create an app, post it in the Play Store, and I'm sure very similarly in the App Store, and it could live forever, let's say, you know. And I don't know if that was necessarily their intention. I mean, apps really do have a shelf life, you know, that the design of an app can get dated. I'm sure some of the very first iOS mm-hmm. or Apple, before iOS was called iOS, you know, some of the very first iPhone apps, if you were to load them up now, I mean, there would be so many ways, not just on the surface, but underneath, as far as how those apps played well then, but aren't up to snuff now for a number of reasons, be it security or be it just, you know, outdated look and just no, a lack of any sort of touch or attention mm-hmm. For years. So I think it makes sense at a certain point. How do you figure out which apps just really don't need to be there anymore?
And just to be clear, apps that include zombies aren't getting kicked out of
yeah,
the app
this
store.
Is not
just zombie apps.
This is not about discriminating against zombies,
okay,
not at
good.
All.
So, thank goodness.
Yeah.
According to Quartz, the largest maker of police body cameras will now use artificial intelligence to analyze the petabytes of video caught on camera. A startup called Dextro analyzes video to make it discoverable, searchable, and curatable. Twitter has used the service to organize the countless hours of Periscope live stream footage. And now Taser International, the military hardware company that makes most police body cams, has acquired Dextro in an effort to understand what's happening in police videos, where the perspective is always moving and the action is often actually off camera. So I found this fascinating, and our police officer friend of the show, Joey, we emailed back and forth because I know he works in mobile forensics, and I said, you know, what do you think about this? He said video is being used so often as evidence, really. I mean, video's everywhere in our world, but for police officers, it's really being used more and more as opposed to paper. And what he says is that a lot of it has to be released as Freedom of Information Act. But when it's released, people's faces have to be redacted, like children or witnesses, right. They have to be redacted. And he was actually tasked with the job of, you know, seeing how long would it take for you to go through this 10-minute video and take out all these faces. And you're a video editor. Anyone who's done any video editing knows that he would say, you know, this would take 5 hours for 10 minutes of video. And if you imagine they're wearing these cameras all the time, that's so much. It would take up so much time. So this really makes sense if you have a robot doing it so that the police officers are not out of a job but can actually use their skills in other ways, as opposed to just the grunt work of like finding this. So it's really interesting that so this can identify three things: objects like vehicles or weapons, places like indoors, outdoors, even beaches, and actions such as traffic stops or foot chases. So I thought this was a really great way of using technology. And then letting police officers use their own creativity and their own brains to really do the rest of the police work.
Yeah, it's such a mountain of data that you get from, I mean, just when you're talking about, well, how many petabytes?
Why do I all say petabytes?
That's okay, because you're hungry. You want a pita, I understand.
Because I want ethical treatment for all animals.
That too, that as well. I mean, when you're talking about this massive amount of information, and not just that, but video footage that is fixed, like say a security camera that's fixed on a corner, like analyzing that for, you know, even with artificial intelligence, I have to imagine would be a lot easier than what you're getting off of a body cam, because a body cam, I mean, it's constant movement. It's constantly different scenarios. It's dark because they're riding in the car. You know what I mean? Like everything is changing. So any way that you can basically eliminate the hours of boring footage, the uneventful stuff, and really kind of zero in and target in on just the important stuff. I mean, that seems like a no-brainer. I can't imagine how what you were describing about going through and blurring faces and doing all that manually. Man, it's so time consuming to do that. Any way that you can bring, I mean, it seems to me like artificial intelligence is the perfect application for something like this.
Yeah. And when you think about how artificial intelligence works, right, you feed it so much data. So if you want to learn about videos or, you know, a lot of the stuff we've talked about, you're feeding it tons of YouTube videos or television shows or anything. Those are purposely filmed. Mm-hmm. There's a certain way that everything will look, and you'll learn from that. But if you're talking about just live streaming, or if you're talking about like what you were saying, like a camera, you know, sometimes it's facing the ground, sometimes it's, you know, that's totally different data that needs to be fed to this AI for it to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Up next, we've had a week or so to digest Snap's IPO, and Kurt Wagner from Recode is going to join us once again to give us his take. But first, let's take a minute to thank Tracker. They're the sponsor of this episode. We're all used to losing our possessions. Newsweek actually reports the average American wastes 55 minutes a day looking for the things they own but can't find. It's time to reclaim that 55 minutes. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past, and I'll tell you how to get one for free. Tracker Bravo locates misplaced keys, wallets, luggage, instruments, bicycles, electronic devices, pets, pretty much anything you can think of in seconds. The coin-sized device is constructed with anodized aluminum for the thinnest, most durable tracking. You can easily attach it to anything, pretty much. It includes a key loop, so you can snap it onto something, or adhesive to stick it somewhere. Tracker is enabled by Bluetooth LE, so the battery lasts up to one full year, and you can add a laser-engraved message to each Tracker Bravo, things like return information or pet information, so someone can get in touch with you. And you can also personalize your tracker with a custom printed image. So you can put your company logo on there, or whatever you want to make it look like your own. Pair Tracker to your iOS or Android device. You can find its precise location with a tap of a button. One tap and you'll hear it. It's that easy. Your phone can track up to 10 devices at once. And you can customize two-way separation alerts so you're notified before you leave your item behind. If you happen to lose your phone, you just press the button on the tracker and your phone will ring even if it's on silent. With over 3.5 million devices shipped, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world, so your lost item shows up on a map, even if it happens to be miles away. If you lose your item, the Tracker app records its last known location on the map, kind of the last point that you were separated from that item. And when another Tracker user comes within 100-foot range of your item, you'll receive a GPS update of where your item is located. Go to thetracker.com right now. Never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you'll get a free Tracker Bravo with your order. That's thetracker.com, promo code TNT, and you'll get your free Tracker Bravo today. And we thank Tracker for their support. All right, Snap IPO is a thing, and we keep hearing more and more about what a public Snap will be. Joining us once again is Kurt Wagner from Recode to talk all about it. How's it going, Kurt?
Hey, Jason, what's up?
Not a whole lot. Let's take a step back first and foremost. Last week, we talked about it, of course, on the show. Snap filed its S-1. We finally got a good look at what's going on behind the scenes. What stood out for you with that initial filing?
I think the thing that was most surprising, and it probably comes from my time covering Twitter too, is the growth stuff. So what we saw from Snap was that over, I believe it was Q3 and Q4, the growth that they saw or were seeing in the beginning half of 2016 kind of started to slow down. And it was right around the same time it coincides with when kind of Facebook and Instagram were just ripping off all of Snapchat's features and totally cloning them into their own products. And I think there's, you know, again, having seen what Twitter goes through with its growth issues and how serious that can be for the company's stock and its long-term health, I think that to me stood out as something that a lot of us probably didn't expect, right? I mean, Snap has been so highly touted and everyone was excited to see the IPO documents. Everyone's excited to see it go on the market. I don't think that people thought like, hey, there could be an actual user growth issue here. And that's kind of what we saw.
Snap a little late to filing this. I mean, we've been talking about in recent months about kind of the Snapification of Instagram, and Instagram's actually done really well in that transition. Do you think that's a factor here?
I think Instagram definitely has something to do with it. It's tough to say, hey, you're too late. You know, they've come in, they've already copied all your stuff because Snap's business wasn't there, right? I mean, you go public when your business is ready and when you feel that you can actually return money to shareholders. And, you know, even Snap's business is really young. I think they brought in just over $400 million last year. They'll probably do around $1 billion in revenue this year. So not insignificant, but also, you know, Facebook, I think, did $27 billion last year. So much, much smaller than, you know, where they ultimately want to be. And you just can't go public until your business is ready. So it's tough to say, hey, they should have done it earlier. I think the challenge will be, can they continue to innovate, right? Can they continue that for the last two, three years, they've done stuff that Facebook can't even do. They've been coming out with new products all the time, and Facebook's only solution is to copy what they're doing. So can they keep doing that? If they can, I think they're going to be fine. That's just a really hard thing to do, as we've seen with other companies. It's not easy to come up with super innovative stuff all the time.
So Jason and I, when we talked about this, we kind of went back and forth about the fact that they called themselves a camera company. And he thought that was weird. And I thought it made sense to me in the sense of how I've seen teenagers really use it. Just it's as a camera. Everything happens. They don't even use their regular camera anymore. Everything happens through the lens of Snapchat in their day. Why do you think they call themselves a camera company?
Well, they've always kind of pointed out that the app opens up directly to the camera. It's the first thing you see. It prompts you to take a video or take a photo and share it with people. It's funny. They define themselves as a camera company. I think a lot of people would define them as a messaging company. I kind of think of them as a media company because of all the Discover stuff they're doing, and where I kind of believe that they see their future as being a place to kind of host original and mobile-only content for a lot of those publishers. So I can see, I think like part of the reason is probably that they want to avoid being a social media company, which is what Facebook is. And so they're saying, hey, look at, we're different. We're a camera company. We're not a social media company. I get that. I think that, you know, these labels and we're all guilty, myself included, of kind of bucketing people into certain categories. I think really Snap could be any of the three I just mentioned. I think they're choosing to be a camera company because it's different, right? With the exception of GoPro, it's not like you're seeing a lot of up-and-coming camera companies. So it just has this different feel to it, and I think they like that.
How much of that is based around kind of their hardware ambitions then, do you think? Because when I think of a camera company, I automatically, like, my brain is forced to think about hardware. Obviously, Snap has spectacles, but that's such a that's so low on any sort of impact, material impact with the company. I mean, but is this a big indicator of kind of their direction for the future once they do the IPO?
I think in some ways, yes. I think you're spot on in that spectacles, and they even said this in the S1, they said this is not material to our business.
Right.
I don't think they expect it to be material anytime soon or maybe even ever. You know, spectacles may always just be like a cool thing that they tried and that created a lot of stir and momentum for them leading up to the IPO. Maybe that was the purpose of spectacles and it'll just only ever be that. I think when they say, hey, we're a camera company, we know that they kind of took a look at Lily Robotics, I believe, the drone company that was kind of like a selfie drone. That ended up shutting down. But the fact that Snap even looked at them as a possible acquisition kind of tells you that they're looking for other hardware projects and other ways to create cameras and create unique ways that you can take video and selfies and photos and all that stuff. So I do think there's something to be said about, you know, the camera company label and building the spectacles. I don't think they are going to be a hardware company at heart. I think that might, you know, be something that they tinker with on the side. I, of course, could be wrong. I also thought they should have sold to Facebook for $3 billion four years ago. So you never know. But they're certainly coming into the IPO with advertising being the front and center around their business model.
So they revealed that they revised the S1 yesterday. This is a two-part question. Is that normal? And what did they resolve and why? So that's the three-part question.
Sure. It is normal. A lot of times companies will go through multiple iterations publicly. I mean, they've gone through, I don't know how many, but I imagine dozens of iterations before we ever even saw the version that we saw last week. They just, you know, did it in private. Now that it's out there, they're still tinkering with the document, formalizing and finalizing the language. So it's not uncommon. What we learned there, you know, really the big thing that jumped out to me was that they have a $1 billion commitment to Amazon to use its cloud services business. And that was a big deal because they had already committed, and we already knew that they had committed $2 billion to Google over the next 5 years for their cloud services too. So now they have $3 billion basically committed and tied up to simply, you know, infrastructure costs. And some people could say, hey, this is good news because they're expecting their back end costs to go up. That means they expect to have more users and more photos and all like more content that they need to host, and therefore they need more space. That's one positive way to look at it. The negative way to look at it is, hey, here's a company that's already losing, you know, $500 million last year, and they have $3 billion committed over the next 5 years. That, you know, that's not great. It's just hard. It's, you know, supporting all of this video stuff in particular is just, it's expensive and it's hard. So they're teaming up with an Amazon and Google. I mean, two of the biggest companies in the world. And I'm sure that they'll be fine, but it's just a lot of money, you know, especially for a company just about the IPO.
Yeah. Being beholden to them right out of the gate. That's a pretty significant. Is there any indication that Snap will kind of aim to have its own solution for infrastructure above and beyond that?
They mentioned that was a possibility. Obviously, because these commitments go through, I believe, 2021, you know, it's not as if they could just like back off of the Google deal tomorrow, right? This is something that they're going to be in for a while. I would imagine that at some point, yeah, they would love to do all their own stuff. Like that's what Facebook does, for example. Facebook has a lot of its own data centers, and they're spending a ton of money to build more data centers moving forward. So it's not cheap. They clearly don't have the revenue in their bank account, the money in the bank account right now to do it on their own, which is why they're paying others to do it for them. But I'm sure if all goes well, if the business goes really well, I'm sure in the long run it's more cost effective and just better for privacy and better for control to obviously do this on your own. So they mentioned they might do that. It's probably a ways away, though.
Do you worry that they are too U.S. centric? I mean, most of their users are within the U.S. And does the fact that they're using Google Web Services mean that they are not going to be likely allowed in China anytime soon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no one's really allowed in China. So that's not really, something that I'd be concerned about for them. I think the U.S. centric thing is really interesting, right? Because the vast majority of their revenue is coming from U.S. and Canada, North America. And you know, it's nowhere near, like, when you look at the metric average revenue per user, right, that a lot of these ad-driven companies use. Facebook's is much higher in North America than Snapchat's, which makes a lot of sense. But, I think if you were to talk to Snapchat, they'd say, hey, we want to get there someday. That's 10x business growth right there just here in the U.S. with our current user base. I think the challenge is going to be that at some point you would think, okay, they cap their user base in the U.S. They cap their user base in Europe. And all of a sudden, you know, they're forced, if they want to keep growing, to move to these other parts of the world, right? To Southeast Asia or to India or to South America. And right now, I don't think that they're capable of doing that. I don't think that they have the structure. I don't think that the app is kind of nimble enough to operate in places where there's only 2G network connections, right? And I think the challenge is Facebook is trying to beat them to all of those places. So Facebook's going to say, hey, in 5 years, when you're ready to go into Brazil, guess what? We already have a Snapchat clone in Brazil, or we already have a Snapchat clone in India. And so, again, this is a further down the line problem, but I think it's a serious thing to think about when you look at their long-term growth. And right now they're clearly focused on markets where they can actually make money, and I think that's smart. But, if all goes well, again, they're going to reach a ceiling at some point. They're going to have to move on, and I don't know what happens. I don't know what happens for them then.
And there was one other part that you mentioned in your piece about updated salary information for one of their board members. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's Joanna Cole. She's one of their, she's not a non-employee, non-investor board member, so an outside board member. She's the only female on the board. And there were some stories last week that in the original version of the S-1, it had her one-year contract from 2016 that she had actually signed at the very end of 2015. And the numbers in terms of compensation, mostly, stock, restricted stock that she was getting, was significantly lower than all of the other board members who were male board members. So, there was this, of course, obvious, hey, the only female board member on Snap's board is being paid significantly less than all of these male board members. What we found out, early this morning, was that she has since signed a new contract. So she had been on a one-year deal that just expired at the end of last year. Signed a new 3-year deal, I believe, in January, and her compensation is comparable with a lot of the other board members. And what I'm told happened was basically when she signed her deal in late 2015, the company was at a very different place. Most of the other board members didn't come on until late last year when it was very clear they were going to be a publicly traded company. So they got deals that were much more lucrative, equivalent to being on a public company board. Now that she's re-signed her offer, she's kind of on the same page with everyone else. And I think people will probably feel better about that because it definitely didn't look great to have your only female board member making significantly less than everybody else.
Yeah, no kidding. Kurt Wagner with Recode. We really appreciate you joining us once again. Thank you so much. Where can people follow all your work online?
Yeah, thank you. You can go to recode.net and read all the our stories there. I'm also on Twitter @KurtWagner8.
Cool. Sounds good, Kurt. Thank you again. We'll talk
thank
to you soon.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Have a good night.
And we should mention that we did mention Amazon Web Services, and they are a sponsor on the network. So just full disclosure there. And now we have an email from Randy, the tech director from Manchester. He says, on episode 1700, you mentioned the Super Bowl halftime drones. I just wanted to share that I saw the exact same drones live at a show over the holiday break at Disney Springs in Florida. It featured 300 drones over the Central Lake. I like this show much better than the typical fireworks show. It was very cool to see forms rotated in 3D space.
Oh, I bet.
It was set to music with a holiday theme, and you can find the show with a quick search on YouTube. The show lasted about 5 to 6 minutes, but I think the full flight time was around 10 to 11 minutes. Speculation on my part, but all this seemed like a practice run for things to come in the main parks.
Well, I hope so, because then maybe that means we'll get a chance to see it at some point, too.
After the break, Facebook wants to help you help your neighbors in need. We'll talk about that how, but first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the sponsor of this episode. If you've ever tried to get a mortgage or refinanced your home, you know it can be frustrating. It can be terrifying sometimes. When it comes to that big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important that you work with someone who you can trust and someone that you know has your best interest in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can adjust the rate and the length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. So whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Because buying a new home shouldn't be a burden. It should be fun and exciting, and you should be able to do the mortgage process in your pajamas. You know what I'm talking about. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. Now, if you've ever read about people in crisis online and hoped you could help, you are in luck. Facebook has launched Community Help. That's a way to put your money where your thoughts and prayers are. Joining us to talk about it is Josh Constein, editor at large for TechCrunch. Welcome, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So Community Help doesn't just let you send money to people or organizations in need. You can help with shelter or food or even transportation. How does it work?
So normally when there's a crisis in the world, like a natural disaster or some kind of, like an earthquake or a flood, people flock online using Facebook safety check to tell friends and family that they're safe, that they're okay. But now Facebook is adding a new page to the safety check, which lets you actually offer people nearby help. And if you're one of those victims of the crisis, you can ask for help. So that includes finding things like food or shelter, pet supplies, baby supplies, transportation, and, you know, being able to offer someone real help rather than just sending your thoughts and prayers is a big deal, because so much of the passion and sympathy and empathy that comes out online after these crises goes unharnessed.
So these people that you're helping, are they strangers? Are they your Facebook friends? And sometimes your Facebook friends could be virtual strangers, but who is it that you're connecting with?
Yeah, it's going to be strangers that are in your local community. And for that reason, there is a little bit of a safety concern, because, you know, if you're going to get some help like staying in somebody's house, if your house is flooded, you're going to want to make sure you know who they are. So Facebook's putting education in the product to let you know that you should check out their profile, make sure they look legitimate. And Facebook's not going to allow brand new accounts or anything that they find suspicious or anyone that they think might be a little risky to use the product. So it should be safe, or at the very least do more harm than it hurts. And this do more help than it hurts.
Right. Thankfully. And this is about targeting or kind of finding people to help on more of an individual one-on-one basis. Is there any way to kind of broaden that out to groups of people, or is it just specifically this person needs my help out of this long list of people? I choose to help them.
Yeah, Facebook's trying to match you to individual people. There's certainly lots of opportunities to get involved, like volunteer or join groups, and that's already going on Facebook. But really what they saw was that people from afar were donating, but a lot of times people don't need money. What they need is a place to stay tonight, or they need a ride to the hospital to visit a family member. They need something. They need real help right this moment. And that's not something that people were getting before. And, you know, I really challenge other social media platforms to look at this model and see what they can do. You know, Twitter, for instance, it's the home of outrage and sympathy when something bad happens, but that doesn't really go anywhere. And so I want to see more social media platforms following Facebook's lead here and going out and doing something that's good for the community and organizing people to allow good to happen through their networks.
Yeah, I agree. So Safety Check, that this was born out of Safety Check, and Safety Check has had some issues with people criticizing, as many of the things Facebook does are criticized for good and bad reasons. At the beginning, it was, you know, they said they were going to help in a disaster. So, and really what people found was that they were only helping people in certain types of the world and not other parts of the world. So how does Facebook really decide what is a disaster? What is considered a crisis? Or are they not the ones deciding this?
Yeah, you know, that was a big problem before. The safety check was always handled manually by Facebook. So they had to watch in the world to see if something bad happened, then choose to manually trigger the safety check and pick who it was applied to. But Facebook's completely overhauled it to reduce the human interaction, make it more streamlined, and make it much more scalable. So now what it does is it waits for global crisis reporting agencies to tell it that something bad has happened and give the crisis a name. And this makes sure that there's no fake news turning into safety checks. Because that's a really big problem, and it could really scare people if something fake turned into a safety check. After that, they're basically going to look for – Facebook will look for people in the affected area that are tweeting or – sorry, Facebook posting about this issue. And if they see enough people are having trouble and talking about this crisis like an earthquake, then they'll trigger the safety check for the people in that area. And they'll message people and say, hey, you talked about this earthquake. Are you safe? And do you want to invite your friends to say that they're safe? And then once that all happens, then they get moved into this new community help feature. But the idea is to reduce human error and prevent there from it being on Facebook or, you know, being Facebook's responsibility to choose what is and isn't a crisis. And also, by using these international reporting agencies, they're going to be able to help with safety checks on in places all around the world, even a tiny plane crash in Eastern Europe.
Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago that those who aren't close, obviously, you know, I'm here. This happens on the other side of the country. I cannot offer, you know, shelter necessarily, but I can offer funds. I can, you know, give to the cause. How do you do that through Facebook at this point? Is it just if people who aren't in the community, near the community, and want to get involved, do they just have to go through the standard outlets like, you know, Red Cross or whatever? Or does Facebook help to facilitate that?
Yeah, Facebook now actually offers fundraising and donate buttons through its website. It saw through the ALS challenge that tons of people wanted to contribute and help out, but they often weren't sure, like, where do I mail a check? What is the actual website I go to donate? And so Facebook built a product that lets you put a donate button right in the status updates. And you can choose that just like you would add a photo to a post. You can choose to add a donate button. And if there's a big cause that you really want to rally support for, you can start a whole fundraising page through Facebook. There's a little tab, a little book mark in the left-hand rail if you're on desktop, or in the more inventory box if you're on mobile. And you can set up a whole fundraiser page and invite friends to come and join and donate. And it's actually doing a lot of good. And they saw millions of dollars raised for the ACLU just recently for Syrian refugee relief. And it's going really far. You know, the ALS challenge generated $200 million in donations worldwide. And Facebook thinks that there's a huge opportunity to do that for more big causes.
Yeah, I really like what you were saying about just the outrage that is on so much of social media, not going anywhere, but just into all our collective anxiety. So what could Twitter, how could Twitter do something like this? Do you have any ideas how they might also use that rage and harness it into good?
Yeah, I think what they really could do is look at the hashtags and say this hashtag is associated with a crisis and may have an opportunity to generate donations. And so, you know, a few years ago when there was the whole Justine Flacco, has Justine landed yet thing, where this woman made a very insensitive joke about AIDS in Africa, you know, all of Twitter exploded making fun of her. But nobody was tweeting links to AIDS charities. Nobody was actually trying to help. Everyone was just being snarky. And I remember at the time, I was really disappointed. And I started trying to tweet links to donation pages, but they just never got that kind of reach that the jokes and the snark does. And so I really think that Twitter should look at seeing how they can add a fundraising button or allow people to add one to their tweets when there's something important. But that also means they're going to have to go to the work of verifying these charities. You know, Facebook has gone, and I think they've verified over 700,000 nonprofits that they think are, you know, worthwhile and are legitimate that you can connect to through the donate buttons. And, you know, it's work, but, you know, Twitter is the place where people talk about what's going on in the world right at the minute it's happening. And that's when the passion is the highest. That's when there's the biggest opportunity to get things done on behalf of the world. So I really want to see these social networks harness the human spirit for positive good, not just clicktivism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. If there was some way to turn that power of public shaming that Twitter is so good,
I know, right?
Into having someone in need sleep on your couch.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and they're not the only ones that can do this. I mean, YouTube has a big opportunity here as well, because people are often sharing videos related to the crises. Instagram is becoming an increasingly popular place to talk about real world events. Even though they have an algorithmic feed and it's all photos, it's still really important. And they don't allow links. And so it's even harder to galvanize support for a nonprofit or do donations from Instagram. But that they could definitely add a donate button, which would, you know, really get different rules than other kinds of links.
Sure.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for coming on. I've followed your work at TechCrunch for a while, and I'm glad to finally get to talk to you. Josh is the editor at large at TechCrunch, and Josh Constein on Twitter. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Josh.
Yeah, please. Thank you.
Take care.
We'll talk to you soon. TNT's fan of the day is David Cantor, who tweeted us saying, and no photo, but no photos needed because I love this. Do Vizio owners still need to tweet how I watch TNT? Because you already know, right? And just to clarify, we have no deal with Vizio to share in its data grab.
Vizio knows. We don't know.
Yeah, Vizio knows. We have no connection to that. We talked about this story earlier this week, of course. But this is just a message to Vizio owners. Still tweet us this. What happened right now with David's tweet? This works for us. So please do this. Don't trust the Vizio is going to share their data with us. They're not going to. And we don't want it. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. And use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT. And we're going to find it. Up next, Google Assistant is about to get even better. In fact, on my phone, it already got even better. But first, let's take a minute to thank Blue Apron. They're the sponsor of this episode. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals for less than $10 per person. Every meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card, as well as pre-portioned ingredients that could be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Seafood sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals. Produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for the recipes that they give you, they're reducing food waste. Use it all in the recipe. It's required. It all needs to go in there to make that meal delicious. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them, and you can kind of tailor that over time. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or just leave it to Blue Apron's culinary team to surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within the year, so you'll never get bored. It's always changing. So some ideas here: cashew chicken stir fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. There's roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad. That sounds awesome. Crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. There's also udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs. Tons of deliciousness. Now it's time for you to get it for yourself. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/TNT. Blue Apron is a better way to cook. All right. Google Assistant. You had a little bit of experience with Google Assistant on the Pixel phone, Megan.
Mm-hmm.
Powers actually also underneath the hood Google Home. And I have one of those at home. I love it. It enables all the home automation stuff, those capabilities of the device for controlling things around your home.
When you want to have a disco party.
Yeah, exactly, which happens very regularly, Megan. But Pixel devices, which also have assistant capabilities, still aren't able to control all the same stuff as your Google Home, even though they're both running on Assistant. Well, now Pixel users are starting to see a new home control section within Assistant that brings all of that advanced smart home control stuff into the phone, so you don't even need a home anymore. I mean, you need a home to live in. You don't need a Google Home if you don't want it, but I still recommend it because Google Home is awesome.
See, that you saying you don't even need a home anymore just highlights how they need to come up with some better names for their stuff. I'm continuing to use a slightly less useful version of Google Assistant in Allo.
Yeah, right.
And
it is less.
Yeah, and someone was trying to train me on Twitter on exactly what to say to make it show pictures of babies, and I never could get it to show pictures of babies.
Really?
It was all
that seems
I
like
had
a
to,
basic thing.
For I know. Show me pictures. It kept showing me cartoon pictures of girls, and babies. Sometimes they were babies.
Sometimes, but by sheer luck,
like cartoons of babies. But yeah, when I said show me pictures, like this baby, can you see that baby? Like that's what it kept showing me. I don't want to see that baby. I want to see pictures.
Well, I mean, it is a baby. It's just not a real baby.
Right. But I was saying, show me my baby pictures in Google Photos. But I've digressed.
I see. Well, no, but that illustrates kind of the weirdness of Google and its products and how disjointed they can be, right? Google Assistant, big effort by Google, you know, announced last year at Google I/O. So they say this is kind of our new thing. You have it on the Pixel, and it does a lot of the things that Google Home can do from a search standpoint, but it doesn't necessarily control your home. On Google Home, it can do a lot of the search things, but it can't do reminders, but it can control your home. On Allo, which I think was kind of where you saw Assistant first, it's less of a does everything sort of thing, and it's more of a kind of like bringing search and some of that expanded capabilities into messaging. So it's like it's Assistant everywhere, but varied kind of capabilities of Assistant. And from a consumer standpoint, that's just one example of how Google has these efforts, and they're great if only they would be consistent between products, because otherwise people are always guessing. Like, they don't understand, what can I actually do with this? Mm-hmm. You can do this over there. Why can't I set a reminder on my Google Home, which I can do on my Assistant on my Pixel phone? I don't understand.
Why?
Why?
Yeah, Siri's the same everywhere except for the Apple TV, and there's a very good reason. Like, they just don't want you to, it doesn't, you don't want your TV talking back to you, so it doesn't talk back to you.
Got it.
And it's only, you know, it right now, it only has capabilities to really do TV stuff. It's not going to do much else than that. And because it's your TV.
Yeah, exactly. Who wants to talk to their TV? Do you, I mean, do you,
I want
ever,
to
do
talk,
you talk to your TV?
I talk to the TV, yeah. I asked the TV last night to show me the Black Mirror episode, Be Right Back, because it was the one that we had talked about. Have you seen that one yet? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I think we oversold it, because when I saw it, I was like, eh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought it was really good.
Well, maybe, really, yeah. Good. I don't know. Maybe my expectations were too high. I thought it was good. We'll discuss later.
All right.
Or you can tweet at me if you want to discuss the Be Right Back episode. Maybe because we'd already discussed all that creepy stuff.
Yeah. Maybe because it's just too close to, it's too close to home now.
Maybe.
It's just that you watch that those shows of that, the episodes of that show, and so much of it is so familiar in a certain way, it's kind of off-putting. Mm-hmm. But that's why I love it. And Burke gets in the words at the very end, Google can't even update help files on their... That is true, on their
T-H-E-I-R,
products.
T-H-E-I-R, Burke.
Uh-oh. Point taken, though. I agree, Burke. Google can help update their help files.
Sorry,
it's true.
I had
lots
to. There, there. It's a pet peeve of
there's fun. There, there.
Yeah. And,
but you wanted there.
Burke needs a copy editor. That's all.
Okay. All right. We'll work on that. That's it for this week's show. God, I keep doing that this week. Today's show. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, midnight UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV.
Find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT and come see us. Just email tickets@twit.tv. And if you want to tweet at me how I'm a grammar snob, please do. I'm at Megan Maroney.
I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Brian Burnett, as always. Thanks to Burke for helping out here in the studio and spelling their wrong. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show. Thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody. Yeah.